From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The dictionary says that an optimist is a person with a tendency to expect the best possible outcome. We all know those people, and maybe you're one of them, who believe the world is improving and good will ultimately triumph over evil. Today we'll spend some time with movers, shakers, and better world makers. And along the way we'll ask you to think about how your public radio station enriches your life, and we'll ask for your support. Are you planning to see the world this year, or enjoy the frugal pleasure of a staycation? Remember, the best travel isn't always about where. It's also about who. Just ask Mark Johnson. He spent years traveling around the world recording street musicians, the kind of buskers you would see in Times Square, on Prague's Charles Bridge, in Piccadilly Circus. He calls his project Playing for Change, and he talks about it with Steve Paulson.
About 5 years ago, I was walking on the streets in Santa Monica, California, where I live, and I heard the voice of Roger Ridley singing the song Stand By Me. I think I was a couple of blocks away from him, and I ran over to catch this performance, and the guy just had so much soul and emotion in his voice that I watched this performance, and then I just walked up to him, and I said, hey, if I come back with some recording equipment and cameras, I'd love to take the song around the world, put headphones on musicians everywhere, and add them to the song. And he looked at me like I was crazy, but he said, all right, if you come back, I'll play it.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.
And I said, Roger, you know, with a voice like yours, what are you doing out on the street? And he said, man, you know, I'm in the joy business. I like to bring joy to people. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever, you know. The best version of Stand By Me with so much soul and emotion with a man in the joy business is a great way to go out and try to connect people. And that was the start of the whole process.
No matter where you go in life, you gonna need somebody to stand by you.
So you recorded Roger playing the song, and then you what, went to travel around the world and played what he did for other musicians and then recorded on top of that?
Yeah, exactly. So the next place I came to was New Orleans after Katrina, and put headphones on Grandpa Elliot, and he would listen to Roger singing and playing, and then he would sing his own verse on top of that song.
And the land is dark, and that moon is the only light we see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't shed one tear just as long as your people come and stand by me.
And then I would go to the Zuni Indians, 10 Indians around a drum in the desert, and they would all listen to Roger and Grandpa, and they would play the drum on top of it, and so on around the world.
This is just an extraordinary collection of musicians you've put together. How did you find all these people?
Well, a lot of it was just spontaneous. I mean, a project like this that comes from people. So a lot of times I just had a roadmap where I knew I wanted to get as many different cultures, religions, races, political point of views, economic status, get as many different people as possible to play songs together. And so based on that, I wanted to pick a lot of different locations. And then I would just sort of show up with a small crew with that iPod video and positive intentions and just find people that would then play it for the other friends. And it would just kind of grew organically like that.
So you would just start traveling around in the middle of South Africa just looking for musicians who might be able to record right. on this record?
You know, that's exactly right.
That sounds amazing, I have to say. It accounts for great faith in your ability to find these
people.
Yeah,
I knew that there's great music all over the world. And I knew that if I had enough different songs, I could find ways of incorporating all different styles. So, for example, in One Love, there's a steel guitar player in New Orleans playing with a sitar player in Kathmandu, Nepal. And those two instruments are very different but have such a similar aesthetic. So I knew that I could kind of find ways to create new combinations of sounds. So I had enough material and enough faith in humanity and in music to go out there and make something that we could all be proud of.
Now, what you've done is you not only recorded the audio of these songs, for a lot of them, you took a film crew around as well. I mean, all around the world and recorded
right.
people doing this. And it's amazing. I mean, this just blows people away. I know it's been hugely successful on YouTube, and I mean, it moves people to tears. Did you know what you were tapping into?
I think that there was a day where we stopped calling it a film or an album and started calling it a movement. And I think that that's when we realized the depth of something like this, because, you know, the music gets to the sentiment behind the words. A lot of times, as beautiful as a religion or political things might be, they often divide people. And music just has a way of transcending any of our differences and helping us be a part of something bigger than ourselves. I started to see it on the faces of the musicians and on their families as we were traveling around the world. And just also, I think a lot of the viral success comes from the fact that the world does want to come together, and this is a great way to do it.
Some places that have had a lot of political unrest, so even civil wars. I mean, you went to the Middle East, to Southern Africa, to Nepal. Did you ever find yourself in trouble?
Well, it was interesting. Like the closest we came to danger became one of the strongest moments to send us to kind of give us strength for the project. We were recording musicians on the streets in Soweto, South Africa. For a long time, that had been the murder capital of the world. And like I said, I would use my iPod video to kind of get people excited about the project or to get them aware of it. And I saw these two guys when I was recording on the street watching us, and I thought they were with our crew. So I walked up to them and I handed them two sets of headphones and an iPod video, and they look at me funny and they watch the video. And at the end, they were very excited and they gave it back to me. And my friend came over to me and he said, "Just so you know, those were the gangsters. And normally they would have robbed you and taken your iPod. But after seeing what you're doing, they told me to tell you they've got your back while you're here, you're safe, and they love what you're doing." And I think that that's when we realized that, you know, we may be naive, but it's more naive to think we got any other choice than using music to connect people. So this is about the human race. This isn't about each of our divisions. This is about our connections. So there's no reason everybody shouldn't be a part of this.
Mark Johnson talking with Steve Paulson about Playing for Change. There's something about that piece that just straight out makes you smile, don't you think? Maybe it will change the world. Maybe it'll just change the next few minutes. In any case, it gives you hope. You can help tell this kind of story by making a pledge of financial support to your public radio station. Here's someone to tell you how. If you really want to understand human behavior, forget about psychology. Take a look at economics. It's self-interest all the way, right? Ron Shaich is the founder of the Panera Bread Company. He gave up his CEO chair to launch a rather astonishing new business model: cafes where customers pay only what they want or can afford. Shaich calls them the Panera Cares Cafes. So why would the CEO of a company with over 1,673 cafes in 44 states with a net worth of some $8 billion step down to run what amounts to a social experiment?
The way customers pay is they put it into a donation box. One of the things that we felt is if we're going to really be straight on this, we couldn't have a cash register. We had to deal with making certain that we didn't put so much psychological pressure on people that those in need wouldn't come in. I can tell you this, Jim. We had a vision for this, a vision for what these cafes would be. And then along the way, we changed everything in developing it. And that's what entrepreneurs do. You have a vision, and then you try to figure out how to get there. And that's what built Panera, and that's what is building the Panera Cares cafes.
So tell me about the first one. Where did you start?
Oh, we started the first one in Clayton, Missouri. We're now 1,500 cafes, close to 1,500. This was one of our original 10 cafes. We wanted a cafe that was economically eclectic. We needed to have people that could benefit from it. And we also needed to be in a neighborhood where there are people that could support it. And so this is a community where there's both million-dollar townhouses two blocks away and the county courthouse and county jail across the street. This is a neighborhood in which there are people that are out running in the mornings and also folks that may be panhandling in the afternoon.
So tell me about that first day. What was it like when you opened up?
You know, it was a great test of humanity. I mean, the real question was, were people going to abuse this? I think there was a fear that people would see it as lunch on Uncle Ron, lunch on Panera, you know?
Sure.
And it's going to be a place that people could abuse and game. It was really a test of humanity. That was test number one. And test number two, the other reason we wanted to do it was we wanted to say to other companies out there, step up and you know, you can do more than just give a check. Yeah. If we can figure out how to take the skills of other public companies like Panera and utilize them for the public good, that is a valuable resource.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a pretty astonishing thing. And I guess I'm just trying to get at what it was like that first day. You must have done some advanced publicity. You told
No, no, no. Actually, it's the opposite.
Oh,
really? We wanted nobody to know about it.
You wanted nobody to know. So people walked in expecting to see prices.
The first issue we had, fascinating, as people began to walk in, was, okay, we have these donation boxes. People don't know what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine you've
well,
had
sure.
10, 15, 20,000 opportunities to walk into a restaurant where you look at a menu board and people tell you what to spend. So I got out there and I started talking to people and I started getting other what we call greeters to talk to people. And we began to have to take every customer through the system. And what we would say to people is, welcome to Panera Cares, our cafe of shared responsibility. This is Panera's gift to the community. We need to sustain this. If we're able to sustain this, we're going to take the resources we generate and use it basically to help at-risk kids. If there are no set prices here, if you have a couple extra dollars in your pocket, feel free to leave the suggested retail price or more.
So just to be clear, you tell people what it would cost if they were at a regular Panera store. So they have some idea. I mean, you know whether this is a $5 sandwich or $6.50 or whatever.
Exactly. On the other hand, we also say to people, right in that greeting, if you don't have the money in your pocket, please, please feel free to take a discount or frankly leave nothing in our donation bin. What we're asking of you as a guest is to do the right thing.
So what was it like that first week? Did people pay?
It was an emotional roller coaster. The facts are that 20% of customers have left more than the suggested retail. That's what they do. About 60% of customers leave the suggested retail, and about 20% of customers leave less than suggested retail. But the ones that leave less than suggested retail leave relatively less than those that leave more. So that net, on average, people are leaving about 80% of the retail price.
This is not a bad business model, is it?
It's not a business model. And I'll explain to you what I mean by that. What fuels this and allows this to exist, and I think it gets partially to your question of are people good, is people don't want to be used and they don't want to be gamed. People are fundamentally good if they feel like they are not being abused and they're not being taken advantage of and taken for fools. And the key to this is that it is legitimately in a nonprofit foundation. Panera is not benefiting in any way from it. The key to this is the transparency that we share with the community. And so I think that this works because people trust it.
Yeah.
People believe in it. And if we in any way violate it, or if in any way it's perceived as people being used or gamed, this doesn't work.
You know, it's the same on both ends of that equation, though, isn't it? I can see that that some people would come in and game the system. That I could see high school kids, for instance, coming in and figuring, and hey, free lunch.
Well, you know, Jim, it's exactly what was so tough those first couple of weeks. that first day, I remember this gentleman who walked in, and he said to me, I know you're one of the guys running this place. He said, let me tell you a story. 3 months ago, I was a tech writer, and I'm a big Panera fan. I lost my job, and my kids haven't been out to eat in 3 months. In fact, truth of the matter is the three kids that are with me today, we don't know where we're going to eat tonight. I don't know where we're going to get the money for food. Can we eat here? You get it. And you realize that with near 10% unemployment, with one out of six kids living in homes with food instability in the last year, this isn't a problem simply of the poor and the poverty-stricken. This is a problem in many of our middle-class communities. And the opportunity to help and touch a gentleman like that makes you feel so good. And our own people get excited about it because they themselves have been through it. On the other hand, Jim, right after you have that, I'm working the counter and I have a local high school kid actually who walks in and says, I'll have three sandwiches and two smoothies. And by the way, here's my dad's credit card. Put $3 on it. I wanted to jump across the counter and string that kid up around the neck. Now, here's the problem we have, right? You know, we can't judge people on their dress. We can't have a 1099 check at the door. We ultimately have to trust people to do the right thing, and we have to get to them and help them to think about what the right thing is and to understand their responsibilities to each other.
Panera Bread Company founder Ron Shaik, he launched a chain of nonprofit restaurants where payment is voluntary. It's interesting to hear about a commercial enterprise that does what public radio stations have done for years, provide a service first and ask for payment after. Folks who listen to your station already know it's possible to ask for trust and get it. You can be a part of that success with a pledge of financial support for your station right now. Here's someone to tell you how. Some time ago, Olga Nunez got an invitation to join an email listserv of more than 21,000 artists. The rules of the listserv are simple. Every day, one person on the list is randomly selected to write an email and send it to everyone else. So, when it's your turn, what do you write? Olga simply wrote a phone number. When someone called, they were asked to record a voicemail memory of scent. She shared some with Ann Strangechamps, like this one.
I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and the memory that I can remember was brought back to me when I went back to my parents' house one summer. And I remember pulling out a box, a shoebox underneath my desk that had postcards and trinkets from high school, and I noticed that there was the small bottle of perfume that my first girlfriend, my first kiss, my first love used to wear. There wasn't much left in the bottle, enough for maybe one more spray, but I opened the cap and the smell just filled me with a sucker punch to the stomach, basically. It just collapsed with the idea of remembering. And, yeah, I didn't quite know what to do with myself. And I sat back, I leaned back, and I think I remained motionless while I was trying to remember. And I just stayed there. I just kind of stayed there. And I closed my eyes, and almost as though closing my eyes would keep that memory where it was, almost as though my closing my eyes would make sure that it wouldn't go away. I know I gave my name and everything, but if you could please just put me as anonymous from Princeton, New Jersey, and don't include her name. Just make up a name. Awesome. I think this is a really cool idea. Good luck with you and your project.
Wow. So right away, that gives you such a taste of... People share so much. They get intimate so fast. Did that surprise you?
It kind of did a little, but I think that there's probably a safety in the phone call. Like, we're so used to email and revealing ourselves, and something about calling this anonymous phone number. The thing that was fascinating to me about that one is that he said her name, and he said his own name. And you could tell he wasn't expecting to tell that story, because at the end he's like, actually, can you delete this? Because I can't. share that much.
Of course, they're not all so heartfelt. Some are just funny. Like,
yes.
I love this one about the guy who remembers, we should play it. The guy who remembers sitting in his mom's car.
It's the memory that sort of always comes back to me. This is going to seem silly, but I have two brothers, and the memory is driving to soccer practice in my mother's red Volvo station wagon and sitting in the middle seat in between both of my brothers. And I am thrown back into that seat any time I smell either of my brother's farts. Now, I know that may seem like some sort of joke, but I assure you that is the truth. It's not as often that I spend time with them or see them as it was when I was a child. So, you know, every time I get the opportunity to smell one of my brother's farts, I really cherish it. thank you. Calling from New York, Brooklyn, but the memory comes from growing up in San Diego, California.
Yeah, that one's just was just hilarious.
Most of them actually don't end up being funny. Like, some of them end up being lighthearted, but they tend to go sort of more personal, and there's only a couple that are really, really funny that make you giggle. It's interesting. I was going to say, I guess the harder memories in print more strongly than the funny ones.
Yeah, it's like getting ambushed by a smell.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
You know, a memory that maybe you don't even remember, know that you have, gets triggered completely out of the blue. Like there's another one called disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
The last strong memory I had that was triggered by a sense was a smell. And I walked into a room and smelled what I always assumed was carpet. Only it wasn't just carpet, it was just a specific carpet sound. And I walked in, and I was transported back to my fifth grade classroom, which had the exact same carpet smell. And I was 11 years old again. And I looked around, and I looked for my friends, because I was there. It was really disorienting, actually. So, but yes, it was a smell. It was the smell of carpet.
Does it make you feel different if you're, I don't know, you're out and about and you're in a crowd? Do you look around at other people and think, each one of these people has a story?
Yes. Yes, entirely. That is a perfect description.
What I'm wondering is, do you feel differently about strangers, about being in the world now?
Yeah, I think I do. I think so much of us, you know, walking around as people, we're very, very guarded. And I think that we actually are all stories, that we're all walking around with these sort of beautiful and lavish internal narratives that we never really get a chance to say or externalize. So I think more than anything, it's exciting to know that there's a way to kind of unlock people and get them to start telling you those stories and to feel very strongly that everyone has these inside them.
That technology that surrounds us can so often, I think so often we see it as dehumanizing in some way or another. And I just have to say, the thing I really love about your project is that you're taking this simple everyday technology that we all use and you're using it for these profoundly humanistic reasons. It feels like you figured out a way to create a gigantic art project with perfect strangers. I mean, make something beautiful together.
I'm so glad you think that. That's fantastic.
Can we end with one more?
Sure.
We have to end with the story of the girl on the escalator in Madrid. I love that one.
I love that one too.
My name is Heather, and I'm in Washington, D.C. When I was a senior in college, I spent about 3 months in Spain teaching English and working with a missionary family there. And it was 3 of the worst months of my life. I hated just about every minute, and I missed my family, and I missed my friends, and I missed my boyfriend, and I just felt so alone. And one day, I was riding the metro home, and as I was leaving the metro station, I got on the escalator behind this old woman And she smelled exactly like my grandmother, who is one of the most important people in my life. And I almost cried standing there riding this escalator in the middle of Madrid because I felt so homesick and nostalgic, but at the same time, I felt so loved and safe. And as we got off the metro, I had to fight the deep urge to ask this complete stranger if I could hug her because, to me, she smelled like love.
That's beautiful.
It's so good.
Olga Nunez talking with Anne Strangechamps about her project that recorded voicemail memories of smell. When you first hear of an idea like that, it seems extraordinary, maybe foolish. And then, when it's explained by someone with passion, it begins to make sense. It's one of the many ways in which stories on the radio add to our lives. And one of the ways you can guarantee they keep coming is by making a pledge of financial support for your public radio station. Here's someone to tell you how. Sprinter John Carlos felt he needed to make a statement at the 68 Olympics. He and other African-American athletes had planned to boycott the Games. But after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, the boycott was called off. So he and fellow runner Tommy Smith came up with their own plan. After winning medals, they raised their gloved fists in the Black Power salute on the podium. The moment is one of the most defiant and controversial in Olympics history. Steve Paulson sat down with John Carlos to talk about that iconic moment.
So, take me to the Games. It was you and Tommy Smith were two of the fastest 200-meter runners in the world at that time. There was a good chance you were going to win medals, get up onto the podium.
Well, you know, any great athlete, you know, when I say great, I mean super great. If you're going to have a bad day, God will let you know when you get out of bed that morning that you're going to have a bad day. We had no qualms or no hesitation about us making the team. We knew that we would make the team. And I told Tommy at the quarter semi, after the quarter semi was over, we had a discussion, and I told him I was disenchanted about the fact that the boycott was called off. And I felt like I wanted to make a statement. What's your take on that? He said, I'm with you. From that point on, we started talking about what artifacts we had we could bring to the table, which was the black gloves, which was a black scarf, which I had a black shirt. I had beads. We decided we would wear black socks out there with our pants rolled up. We had no shoes out there. And each and every one of these symbols had a specific meaning. And if you bear me the time, I'll explain them to you. The black glove was based on the fact that we felt with an open fist, there's five people of color, and each one of them are very sharp, have a very strong paradigm as to how things could be better. But either one of them step out on his own to move a pebble, he couldn't move it. But then when you say, all right, the next time we come together and say we have a unified vision as to how we can make things better, such as a possibly a boycott or what have you, and all these people come together in a very powerful force, well, you couldn't move a pebble by yourself. Now, unified, you can move a mountain. That was the concept of the fist and the glove. The scarf on Tommy's neck was to show black pride. I had a black shirt over my USA jersey to indicate that there was sorrow about the fact that we had to go to this extent to get America to wake up and realize its misdeeds in society. Then we decided that the beads that I had on my neck would be for all of the lynchings that had taken place that I've read about and heard about as a young kid coming up in this great country of ours. And then we wore no shoes with long black socks to indicate those individuals that was in the South at that particular time, and I'm sure they're still there today, walking to and from 10, 20 miles to school without shoes. We wore the Puma shoe, or we put the Puma shoe out there merely because the Puma shoe was a shoe that was a concern about people of color that didn't have the means to go out and buy the proper shoes, but they was very kind-hearted to give individual shoes before they even got a reputation.
So you did all this. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary what you're describing. The symbolism there is overpowering. You got the bronze. Tommy got the gold. Peter Norman from Australia got the silver. All up on the podium there. And then when they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, you and Tommy raised your fists.
We walked out, I mentioned to Tommy that, hey, man, you remember when we go out there, I said, people are going to be applauding, and then there's going to be a void, and that void would be total silence because they would be in a state of shock once we started to perform our deeds. And at the same time, I told Tommy, remember, we've been threatened. Our lives have been threatened. So remember this, man.
Well, why had you been threatened?
Well, based on the fact that we was proposing an Olympic boycott. They felt it was anti-American, you know, and many of the haters out there didn't particularly like the fact that you would step back. They feel that, oh, we giving you this honor. No, you didn't give me an honor. You set a standard. I took the honor to step up and qualify to make the Olympic team. I want America to represent young individuals in regards to what their ethnic background is as much as these young individuals honor America. That's what our stand was then. That's what my stand is today. So when we went out there, I told Tommy, be careful, man. We've been trained to listen to the gun. If you hear the gun, hit the deck. We went out there. We put the shoe down on the victory stand as they acknowledged us. Tommy, I believe, raised his glove and the shoe on his foot up to the spectators. And then when we received our medals and we turned to the right to the flag and they started to sing the national anthem, and then we come out with the gloves and raise our fist to the sky. And it's just like I said, this void came over to the point where it was silent for a matter of seconds. And then it went from silence to total screaming of the national anthem. It's almost like they were singing the national anthem in a sense that we're going to shove this American national anthem down your throats whether you want it or not.
And then you got booed, right?
Oh, it was a tremendous amount of boos.
What was the fallout for you personally? I mean, for starters, just as an athlete, weren't you kind of ostracized by the track and field establishment?
Well, I was ostracized to a sense, you know, but I wasn't weak enough that they could run me away. I decided that I was going to run for 2 years, and I always thought about how they tried and slammed down our throats that national anthem, and I wanted to slam down their throats that I was going to be the best in the world. Anybody you bring, I was going to wear them out for you to let them know I'm here to run, and I'm here for anybody you want to bring against me. But yet and still, you know, I had aches and pains relative to the demonstration. I would say that probably the most important thing that was most hurting or disturbing to me was my first wife took her life as a result of the Olympics, the pressures that were put upon us, the lack of money into our household, the contempt that came into our household.
No, and you should elaborate on that because, I mean, reading your book, the FBI followed you. Oh, they would plant rumors about you. You
put rumors out. Well, it's no different than what they do today to anyone. They did the same thing to Dr. King. And then at the same time, my kids had to endure our ridicule in school merely because when the teachers found that they were my kids. So I had to endure all of these things. I remember I had to give you $100 here, $200 there, and get somebody to drive me to Vegas just so I could roll the dice to pay my mortgage. 29 days out of the month. If it was 30 days, I'm working 29 days to get my mortgage payment so my kids wouldn't live in the street. And I remember chopping up my furniture, taking my kids and tell them, take your clothes out of the bureau drawer and put it on the floor there. And I would go take a claw hammer and chop that furniture up and go put it in the fireplace because I could not pay my electric bill. I didn't have groceries. I had some dear friends that came and said, John, I don't have much, but I see you don't have nothing in your cabinets, and came and put food in my house. Many individuals walked away from me at that particular time that I thought was my friends. It took me a minute to find out that they walked away not because of disrespect or dislove. The majority of them walked away for fear of reprisal. If you was associated with John Collins, what's happening to him can come and happen to you as well.
Did you ever have any regrets for what you did back in Mexico City?
No regrets whatsoever. And if it was necessary for me to step up tomorrow, I would never hesitate to step up for what I feel is right. People say, you sound like you're still running. Sound like you still got the fire. Well, the fire was with me when I came. The fire being with me when I left until justice is brought here for all men, women, and children on this planet. Someone has to step up in order to make it better. What good is my life being here if I'm here and I got kids and grandkids coming into this world and I'm in a position where I could bring attention to something to try and make us solve this problem or make it a better situation, and now I'm getting ready to leave and I haven't done anything to try and make a better life for my kids or their kids. That's what it's about.
Thank you.
Right on.
John Carlos tells his story in his autobiography, The John Carlos Story. Steve Paulson spoke with him. All these years later, that story is still memorable. No matter what you thought at the time, or no matter what you think now when you hear about it, it's a story you can't forget. It makes you think. That is public radio at its best, the kind of storytelling we need to support. You can make a pledge of financial support for your public radio station right now. Here's someone to tell you how.